Tonight we're actually going to be all over, but I'm going to let you start off in the book of Mark. And I was thinking about what I thought the Lord might have for us and what direction he wanted me to go. I was having a hard time, and I was having a hard time because I was distracted. As I mentioned this morning, we've had a lot of bumps while we were here. I hate to call them problems because I really think they're just opportunities for God to show off. But we had a lot of bumps along the way. Right after we first got here a couple weeks ago, Linda's bass, we noticed there were some cracks in one of the seams. And in my good fix-all handyman mentality, I got out a roll of duct tape and started duct taping everything I could find. Just really not what I recommend you do to an upright bass. But it held for the night. And we got out the next night and we were going to sing, and I opened up the bass case, and the entire back of the bass had just let go from the instrument. And all of the glue seams broke, and it was about 10 minutes till we were supposed to get up and sing at camp meeting, and we kind of went into a panic. And now I'm 700 miles from home. I have to find somebody that knows how to work on a bass that was made 30 years before I was made. And it was not an easy task, but we found somebody over in Reading, and he did a good job, put it back together for us. And next thing you know, our van is broke down, and along the way, a couple other things happened, and it just has kind of kept me right on the edge the whole time we've been here, just distracted. And I was trying to figure out, Lord, what do you want me to get from this? There's always there's a lesson, there's a goal, and I decided that maybe what he wanted is to talk about some of those storms, those things that we go through that make us better. I have a testimony, and I won't bother to give it to you tonight, but we give it all across this country about the very first time we went on the road together and all the problems that we had while we were out. And when it was happening to us, as we were going through it, it was just that. It was problems, and it was chaos, and it was worry. But now over the last 2 years, as I've been able to tell people what God did for us, we've watched people walk the aisle. We've watched people weep. We've watched people come back to God and renew their faith because I got to spend a couple days in a storm learning a lesson about what faith really was. And it occurred to me that none of us would have testimonies to tell if we didn't first have storms that we went through. Regardless the size of those storms, regardless the intensity, without the storms, we couldn't talk about how good God is, because who would want to hear that everything is sunshine and roses all the time? Because it ain't sunshine and roses for the rest of us. You know, and we're already promised in the Bible, in the book of Peter, and you won't have to turn there, but he says, "Beloved, think not it strange concerning the fiery trials, which is to try you, as though some strange thing has happened to you." In other words, Peter was saying, why does it surprise you that these things go wrong, that these things happen? We watch the ministry of Christ, and from the time that he began his ministry to the time that he went back to his Father, it was nothing but trials. The Pharisees and the scribes were continually after him. The people were following him around, not because they wanted to believe on him, but because they wanted to see the show. And he had to be overwhelmed the whole time. And then we think that our Christian life is going to be different, that it's going to be all fun and games. And I thought we'd take a few minutes tonight, and let me show you from the Bible three things that God's given me for us to remember in a storm. Before we go any further, I'd like to pause and open in prayer. Dear Lord, I thank you again for the opportunity you've given me to stand here, Lord, behind this pulpit. And Lord, the blessing and the honor that you've provided for me to open your word and try to give to these people what you've given to me. Lord, I ask as I always do that you would move me out of the way, that you would hide me behind the cross, and that you would shine forth before me, and that it would not be me and my words that these people hear, Lord, but your word. I ask that you would give me clarity, that you would block out all the distractions of the day. Lord, that you would do the same for these people, that you would allow them for these few brief moments to just hear from you, that we would once again be refreshed and renewed. And I thank you for this, and we'll give you all the honor and the glory for it. In your name, amen. I said, we're going to be in the book of Mark. We're going to be in chapter 4. And out of respect in the reading of God's word, if you could and you're able, if you would stand with me, we're going to read from chapter 4 of the book of Mark. We're going to look at a story that I think you'll all find very familiar. We're going to take a little bit of a different spin on it. In the book of Mark in chapter 4 and in verse 35, he says, "And the same day, when the even was come, he saith unto them, Let us pass over unto the other side. And when they had sent away the multitude, they took him, even as he was, in the ship. And there was also with him other little ships. And there arose a great storm of wind, and the waves beat into the ship, so that it was now full. And he was in the hinder part of the ship, asleep on a pillow. And they awake him, and say unto him, Master, carest thou not that we perish? And he arose and rebuked the wind, and said unto the sea, Peace, be still. And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. And he said unto them, Why are ye so fearful? How is it that ye have no faith? And they feared exceedingly, and said one to another, What manner of man is this, that even the wind and the sea obey him?" We're going to start with that thought. You may seat it if you would, please. And we're going to look first. I said this morning there are no wasted words in Scripture. Everything that's in here for a purpose. I don't believe the Bible would ever ask a question that it didn't give us the direct answer for. And in the last verse, in the end of verse 41, there was a question asked. They said, "What manner of man is this that even the wind and the sea obey him?" And I thought, what better thing to do than to answer that question? I was taught by another evangelist that when we find something in Scripture that we don't understand, the best way for us to learn about it is what he called principle of first mention. In other words, we should go find that word or that thought the first time it was ever used in the Bible and get context, get understanding. So if we're going to answer the question, what manner of man is this? Or better yet, why did the wind and the seas obey him? We need to back up and find the answer to that question. And the best place to start with any question is at the beginning. We're going to go all the way back to Genesis chapter 1. There's a lot of things in your Bible that might be hard to find, but this one's not hard to find. Just open until you get to the very first verses of the Bible. Genesis chapter 1. And we're going to look at the first five verses of the first chapter of Genesis. You've read this many, many times, I'm sure, and it says, "In the beginning God created the heaven and the earth. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And God said, Let there be light. And there was light. And God saw the light that it was good. And God divided the light from the darkness. And God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And the evening and the morning were the first day." Now, if I was to ask you, what's the very first thing that God created in these first five verses? What would you tell me? First thing that he created? Light. And that's what I was taught as a child, light. If we read a little closer, that's not actually. That's how he ended the day, and in fact, that's what it said. Evening and the morning were the first day. But actually, what it says there in verse 2, in verse 1, in the beginning God created the heaven and the earth, and the earth was without form and void. In other words, the earth was not what we know it to be now. It was not this sphere broken into continents and islands and land and water. It goes on to say, in fact, that it was without form and it was void, and that darkness was upon the face of the deep. And that God moved on the water. What God created when he spoke that very first moment was essentially a big ball covered in water. In fact, if we go on and we look down at verse 9, quite a ways later, it says, "And God said, Let the waters under the heaven be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear." So up until verse 9, there was no dry land. There was a big ball without form. It was void, and it was covered in water. The very first thing that God ever created was water. And then we move a little further into verse 6, and it said, "And God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters. And God made the firmament and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament." And so it was. "And God called the firmament heaven." So what God did is he said, there's this big ball of water that's going to be the earth. And he separated part of the water and he pushed it up into what would be our atmosphere. And some of the water stayed below in what eventually is our seas and our bodies of water. And he created this void in between. And he said, I'm going to call this the firmament, the heaven. This gap, this expanse. And as we move on through Scripture, and we won't bother to read it, he starts to tell us about the flood several chapters later in Genesis chapter 7. And I'll read the one verse for you just so that you can understand it. In Genesis chapter 7, it says, in the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, in the 17th day of the month, the same day were all the fountains of the great deep broken up, and the windows of heaven were opened. What did God call the firmament when he split it there in Genesis? He said, and he called the firmament heaven. And seven chapters later, he said, and I opened the windows of heaven. I broke this bubble of water that was around the earth, and it came crashing back down. And we saw the global destruction of the planet, and God saved the select few that were in the ark. So the very first thing we ever learn about God was that God had complete and utter control over water. He created it. It was the first thing he ever created. He separated it. He split it. And when it came time to judge the earth a few hundred years later, he did it with water because he had complete control. The first miracle that we see Christ do in the Bible, who can tell me what it was? The very first miracle. Turned water into wine. Took plain water, turned it into wine. Once again, showing his absolute control over everything, but in this case, over his creation, over water. So now let's rush back ahead to where we were in the book of Mark, and let's see what's going to happen with this water, God's very first creation. The disciples that we see here in this boat are actually out in the Sea of Galilee, and if you know anything about the landscape of Israel and Judea, the Sea of Galilee is the central water system, and it's about 64 square miles. It's about 8 miles across. It's roughly the size of Washington, D.C. It's not a huge body of water, but it's big enough. It's maybe 200 to 300 feet at its deepest point, and it was a major traffic area for ships of the time that they would get from place to place. And what's unique about the Sea of Galilee is all around the edges of it is mountainous and cliffs. And it's kind of almond-shaped, and it's open on the ends. And because of this geographical shaping of the Sea of Galilee, it's very prone to storms. They move in very fast. They can be perfectly calm and placid 1 minute, and the next minute it's a raging torrential storm. Kind of like life. Everything's going just great, and the next thing we blink and it's all coming apart. And that's kind of how the Sea of Galilee is. And we see these men in chapter 4 of Mark, in verse 37, he says, and there arose a great storm of wind, and the waves beat into the ship so that now it was full. Picture this. There's these disciples. Most of them were fishermen. They grew up around water. They understood water. They understood boats. And they're out in this ship, and the storm is crashing and raising. This isn't a little tiny rowboat. This is a fishing ship, probably 30 to 50 foot long, a big boat. And these men were raised to know how to deal with this. But it says that the boat was now full. And you can imagine these men were starting to panic. In their experience, they knew what happens when a boat's full of water and the waves are breaking over the side, and you've done all you can do, and you're still going down. And one of them turns to the other and says, where's Christ? I don't know. We haven't seen him. Is he in the back? And they're running back and forth, and they're trying to find him, and they realize he's in the hinder parts, if you will. He's in the bottom of the ship. And they go to him, and they wake him up, and they say, what do they say? Christ, can you help us? No. They say, don't you care? Now think about that. Their initial comment, their response to the God that created everything was, have you stopped caring about us? Not, can you help us? Is there something you can do? It says, carest thou not? Isn't that how we treat God? As soon as things get rough, I was talking before they sang that song. You let things get hard, you let things get dark. We don't question whether or not he's going to get us out. We're not going to question how quickly he can get us out. We question whether or not he even cares anymore. We question whether or not he's even looking out for us. And here Christ was. Where does it say he was? He was in the hinder part of the ship, asleep. You see, Christ wasn't surprised by the storm. It wasn't a shock. He didn't just go down and go to sleep because he figured, you know, I'm on a boat, what else can I do? He went down and went to sleep because he wasn't worried. I don't know about you guys, but when I'm worried and I'm stressed and I'm fretful, I don't sleep. I toss and I turn and I struggle and I get up and I lay down and I get up. And where was Christ? He was in the bottom of the boat sleeping. And when they came and they woke him up and he came out on the deck, he just spoke and the water stopped. Because see, water was his very first creation. And he had ultimate control over it. But what I love about this verse that I overlooked for years, it doesn't just tell us that Christ was asleep. What does it say about him? It says Christ was asleep on a pillow. I don't know if y'all ever been on a fishing vessel, but they bring a lot of things. They bring nets and they bring lines and they bring tools. Christ brought a pillow because he already knew everything was going to be all right. He already knew where that ship was going. He knew the storm was coming and that he was going to be able to control it. And Christ got his pillow and he went to sleep. And the first thing we need to remember when we walk into any storm is Christ brought a pillow. We go into a storm, we want to bring our knowledge and our ability and what we can do. I've told people before, when we're on the road, I have the mentality, I'm the father, I'm the authoritative figure, I'm the guy that's supposed to make sure everything's all right. And I'm slowly learning, and it's a whole lot better to just bring the pillow and plan on resting because God's got this in control than to come in and worry about whether or not I'm the guy that can handle all the situation, that can fix it. So when we go into a storm, it's a whole lot better to go in knowing that Christ brought a pillow to his storm. We see another storm just a little bit further on in Mark, if you'll flip over to chapter 6. What amazed me as I read this, the whole ministry of Christ is only 3.5 years long. So from chapter 4 to chapter 6, we don't know exactly how long it is, but you can bet it's pretty short. If it was a whole month, it would amaze me. And in chapter 6, all the way down in verse 45, it says, "And he..." Christ. "And straightway he constrained his disciples to get into the ship and to go to the other side before unto Bethsaida, while he sent away the people. And when he had sent them away, he departed into the mountain to pray. And when even was come, the ship was in the midst of the sea, and he alone on the land. And he saw them toiling, rowing, for the wind was contrary unto them. And about the fourth watch of the night, he cometh unto them, walking upon the sea, and would have passed them by. But when they saw him walking upon the sea, they supposed it had been a spirit and cried out. For they all saw him and were troubled. And immediately he talked with them and saith unto them, Be of good cheer, it is I. Be not afraid. And he went up unto them in the ship, and the wind ceased. And they were sore amazed in themselves beyond measure and wonder." Now, there's some things in here. I told you this morning I have a phrase called no wasted words, and there's some words in this that just scream at me. In verse 48, it said, "And he saw them toiling and rowing." I told you the Sea of Galilee is 64 square miles. It's about 8 miles. Where did it say the disciples were? They were in the midst. They were in the middle of the water. So we can pretty much assume they were roughly 4 miles offshore. Christ was standing on the land. And being the powerful, mighty, all-knowing God that he was, he saw exactly what their problem was. He saw exactly what they were going through. It didn't mean he visibly, although I believe that he could visibly see them. It means that when Christ looked at them, he knew what the problem was. Just like when Christ looks at us, he knows exactly what we need. He knows exactly what our problem is. He knows exactly what our struggle is. And 4+ miles away, he stood on the shore and he saw them. just like he sees us. And what were they doing? They were toiling, they were rowing, they were struggling, just like we do. We get into the water, we get into the storm, and instead of just letting go and letting God, we struggle and we fight and we toil and we work on it. And try as we might, our solutions will never be enough. Our work will never be enough to fix the problems that we're having. And when he walked out on the water, I thought this was an interesting phrase. It bothered me for a long time. It says, and he would have passed by them. Now, if you look at this same telling, I hate to say this story because there are no stories in the Bible. These are factual events. If you look at this event in the other Gospels, they don't use this phrase. It's the only time we ever see it. And he would have passed by. And I thought, why? Why? What happened? Why would he have walked on by and left them in the storm that they were in? But what did they do? When it says that he would have passed by, and we read a little further, and it says, and they cried out. See, that's what God's waiting on. God's waiting on us to let go of our solutions and cry out to him. And without that act of submission, he has no reason to come to us. He has no reason to help us when we don't ask him. See, part of the free will that we like to talk about, God created all of us with free will. We can choose salvation. We cannot choose salvation. That free will is bigger than that. I can choose to serve him. I can choose to not serve him. I can choose to cry out to him in my storm, and I can choose not to. God doesn't just help us because we're his. God helps us because we cry out, because we ask him. But how often are we short-sighted and caught up in what it is that we've got going on? But they cried out, and it said, to their amazement, to their surprise, Christ once again stepped on the boat and calmed the storm. And the second thing I need you to remember about the storms of life, Christ didn't come to them in a rowboat. What did it say? It said he walked out. The boat's completely optional. Our solutions are completely optional. Christ didn't need a boat to be out on the water in the storm. He didn't need their experience and their knowledge to get through the storm. He just needed God. And the boat is always optional. In this same event, in the telling in the book of Matthew, there's a section that they don't tell us in Mark. Peter was on the boat, and when he saw Christ on the water, he called out to him and he said, if it be you, call me out. Let me come to you. And we know that Peter got out of the boat and he started to walk to Christ. But when he was out on the water, he started to look around and see the storms and see the waves. And he took his eyes off Christ and he got worried and he began to sink. Just like we do when we get in. Because it's not just the crying out. It's not just the turning it over to God. It's not a one-time event. Peter had the faith. He got out of the boat. He began to walk to Christ. But when he took his eyes off of him and he allowed what was going on around him and his fears to creep back in and overwhelm him, he immediately began to sink. And that's the same problems that we have. And Christ said, O thou of little faith, when he spoke to him. He didn't mean little like you don't have very much. He meant little like it's short-lived. You had the faith to get out of the boat, but then you lost all your faith when it came time to keep walking to me. But if we go back to the book of Mark, and I'm going to wrap this up with, if you will, the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey would say. See, normally when we read this, and we read chapter 4, and we see Christ come to the boat, and the storm is calmed, and the waves subside, and they go on with their journey. And we kind of think that's the end of it. But it's really not. If you pick up in chapter 5, in chapter 5, in the very first verse, it says, and they came over unto the other side of the sea, into the country of the Gadarenes. And when he, Christ, was come out of the ship, immediately there met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit, who had his dwelling among the tombs, and no man could bind him, no, not with chains, because that he had been often bound with fetters and chains, and the chains had been plucked asunder by him, and the fetters broken in pieces. Neither could any man tame him. And always, day and night, he was in the mountains and in the tombs, crying and cutting himself with stones. See, there was this man. We call him the maniac of Gadara. He was a possessed man. And they had run him out of town because he was dangerous, because he was continually hurting himself and most likely others. And it said they would try to tie him up and constrain him, and that he would just break the ropes and he would break the chains. And the demons that were in him badgered and beat and persecuted him constantly for years. And as such, he had went out to the tombs and to the hillsides away from town looking for some kind of solace. And in his ravings and in his madness, he would go into the tombs on the hillsides around the Sea of Galilee, and he would revel in the storms, in his wildness and his insanity, if you will. He would find solace in the crashing and the screaming of the waves and the pounding of the storms that were going on. And this particular night, that's what he had done. And I had someone tell me one time that if you study the cliffs that are around the Sea of Galilee, they have this incredible acoustic property that you can be standing up on the cliffs in the mountains and hear for miles out across the water. And I can just imagine on this particular night when the storm was raging and crashing over the boat and the boat was beginning to sink, and he was up on the hill and he was cackling and laughing and watching the little boat being tossed about in the water. And then he saw someone get out and walk on the water. And in a minute, this man stepped on the boat and spoke, and everything went calm. And he said, "That's what I need. That's what I've been looking for. I need what he has." And from the hills to the shore is quite some distance. But he must have run to get there so that he could meet the boat that was now coming in on the calm waters. He had been searching and struggling his whole life to rid himself of this persecution that was bound in him. In fact, in verse 6 it says, "And when he saw Jesus afar off, he ran and worshipped him and cried with a loud voice and said, 'What have I to do with thee, Jesus, thou Son of the Most High God? I adjure thee by God that thou torment me not.'" Now, that's interesting. You ran to meet him so that you could send him away. But it wasn't the man that was speaking. It was the demons inside of him. And what struck me as really interesting is, how did he know it was Jesus? He'd never met him before. This was a maniac. This was an insane man that lived in the graveyards. And yet, he called him by name. And the reason he called him by name is even the devil knows who Christ is. Even the devil knows who God is. And they knew when they saw him. There's no one else that could speak to the water and calm it. There's no one else that could walk on the water. And they knew exactly, and they were afraid, because they knew that there was no one else that had the power that he had, and that even they would be bowed in subjection to him. And it goes on in verse 9, and Christ, and he says, "And he," Christ, "asked him, 'What is thy name?' And he answered, saying, 'My name is Legion, for we are many.' And he besought him much that he would not send them away out of the country." If you know anything about this word legion, a Roman legion is a military term, and it was 2,000 men. And this demon had taken this name to represent that we were, as it said, we are many. This man was not possessed by one demon. He was possessed by many, many demons. But I thought it was interesting in the verse there, and they said that he would not send them away out of the country. Well, that doesn't make sense. If Christ is going to cast demons out, he's not going to send them off into the country. He's not going to allow them to torment others. So I looked in the other Gospels to see how it was said. And in the book of Luke it said, "And they besought him that he would not command them to go out into the deep." Now, well, that really didn't help me much more than out into the country. Why would Christ send them out into the water? So I got out my handy-dandy computer and I looked up what these words could mean. And if we look up the word "the deep" in how it was originally written in the Greek, this word is abyssos. It's where we get our word abyss from. The next time we see this word, or at least we see it in context, is in the book of Revelations. And in Revelations chapter 20, and I'll just read it for you, but in chapter 20 it says, "And I saw an angel come down from heaven, having the key of the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand." This phrase, bottomless pit, in the book of Revelation, do you know what the Greek word is for that? Abyssos. The deep. And when it says that when he came down and he brought with him the keys of the bottomless pit and the great chain, and this is the chain that he's going to bind Satan with when he casts him into the bottomless pit. And these demons said to Christ, "We know what's coming in the end, but don't send us there now. Don't send us to the bottomless pit. Send us somewhere else. Do anything but that." Because they knew exactly who he was and that their end was coming. And they just weren't ready yet. They didn't want it. And then I thought, but haven't we seen this word before somewhere? This, the deep. And then it occurred to me when we started, and we said, let's answer the question of who this man was. And we went all the way back to the book of Genesis. And in the second verse of the first chapter, it says, "And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep." And when you go look up this word, the deep, it's tahau, it's a Hebrew word. But it's where we get our Greek word, abyssos. And it means the abyss, the pit. See, when God created everything on the very first day, being the all-knowing, all-powerful God that he was, he already knew that man was going to fall. He already knew that Satan was going to turn on him. And when God created the earth, at the very same time, he created the pit where he was going to put the Satan and the demons that follow him. Because God is an all-knowing, all-powerful God, and he already had the plan made. This maniac came to him and said, "Please help. Please get these out of me." And it goes on in verse 11, and it says, "Now there was nigh unto the mountains a great herd of swine feeding, and all the devils besought him, saying, 'Send us into the swine, that we may enter into them.' And forthwith Jesus gave them leave, and the unclean spirits went out and entered into the swine, and the herd ran violently down a steep place into the sea, and they were about 2,000, and were choked in the sea." There were a lot of things here that amazed me. First of all, it said Jesus gave them leave. These demons that had been persecuting and tormenting this man for years could do nothing without asking God's permission first. Not even leave him to get away from the Christ that was getting ready to cast them out. And they said, and Jesus gave them leave. And as I said before, and they were about 2,000, because that's what legion meant. This man had over 2,000 demons in him that went out into the over 2,000 swine. And he had been tormented and persecuted this way for many, many years. But here the demon was finally gone, and the maniac finally got help. And in verse 15, it says, "And they came, they, the townspeople, came to Jesus and see him that was possessed with the devil and had the legion sitting and clothed in his right mind. And they were afraid." Isn't this how the world is? Here, this man that they had cast out, that they had sent away, that was a danger to himself and others, and now that he's healed, what does it say? "And they were afraid." See, the world has no understanding, no knowledge, no concept of the goodness of God. And it amazes and baffles them so much that when they see it, they're afraid of it. And in verse 18, it goes on and said, "And when he was come into the ship," he being Christ, "when he was come into the ship, he that had been possessed with the devil prayed him that he might be with him. Howbeit Jesus suffered him not, and saith unto him, 'Go home to thy friends, and tell them how great things the Lord hath done for thee, and hath had compassion on thee.' And he departed, and began to publish in Decapolis how great things Jesus had done for him, and all men did marvel." See, the last thing I want you to remember about the storms of life, yes, Christ brought the pillow. Yes, the boat was optional, because he already had the power. But the biggest thing we need to remember about our storms, they may not very well be about you. See, the disciples were out in the middle of the sea, and the water was crashing, and they were going under, and they went to Christ, and they said, "Don't you even care?" And I can imagine Christ thinking in his mind, You have no idea what's going on. There's a man standing up there on the hill who's been tormented his entire life, and he's about to see God. And you guys are worried about the storm. See, when we go through the storms, chances are it's not even about you. Chances are it's about those that are around you and how you can touch their lives and how you can affect them by showing forth the mighty power of the God we serve. And as we go through our storms in our day-to-day life, our focus needs to be on how can I glorify God through this storm that I'm in so that the people around me can see the God that I serve, so that I can draw others. It said that the maniac, what did he ask him to do? He said, go home to thy friends and tell them how great things the Lord hath done for thee. And at the end of verse 20, and all men did marvel. This maniac got healed, this maniac got saved, and then the maniac went back to where he came from and told everybody that he knew, and all men did marvel, because that's our job too. When we come out of the storms, we don't just go on with our lives. We go share it with other people, and we tell them about what God's done and how good He is to us and how good He's wanting to be to them if they'll just stop and accept the free gift that He's given. I'm going to ask Abigail to come to the piano. We're going to stand to our feet, and we're only going to be a few moments.